This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to Talk Louisiana, originating from the Investar Bank Tower in Baton Rouge. And your number is 877-217-5757, 877-217-5757. Emails go to talk@talklouisiana.org. We're pleased to start with one of the most celebrated sports writers of our time, Armin Katayan, 11-time Emmy Award-winning journalist. He has collaborated with John Talty, the national college football writer for CBS, for a book about where we are in college football, the price, what it takes to win in college football's era of chaos. And LSU opens Sunday, Las Vegas, against USC. The Tigers are slight favorites. Southern University will be on the road at McNeese State Saturday. Armin Katayan, good morning to you.
Good morning, Jim.
Nice to talk with you. It's been a while, but you say we're living in the wild west of college sports. How so?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's an easy question and a complicated answer, but I think you could probably start with the transfer portal, and then you throw in NIL, and you throw in massive realignment and billions of dollars pouring into college football and the upcoming playoffs, now 12 teams, and you know, the book is called The Price for a Reason, not just the financial implications, and certainly now the revenue sharing with the actual people that are doing the labor, at least a vast amount of the labor. But it's also the psychological toll, the emotional toll, the physical toll that's being taken on everyone who makes their livelihood in this game. And, it's a tumultuous period. I think I've covered college football in one form or fashion, got dating back to my days at SI in the mid-80s, and I've never seen it like this. Jeff Benedict and I did a book, you may remember, back in 2013 when Coach Kelly was at Notre Dame and they were playing Alabama for the national championship. That book was called The System. And this is kind of the System 2.0, but what Jeff and I were exploring back in the 2010s really kind of seems like child's play compared to what the coaches and the people who really love the game, and I mean from, university presidents, to athletic directors, to compliance people, to assistant coaches, to head coaches, to the TV people, to conference commissioners, everybody's mm-hmm. trying to figure out one way or another how to get their hands around something that really is very, very difficult to see what the future looks like.
Well, I saw a story that Brian Kelly, who you mentioned, the LSU coach, says that LSU will invest about $17 million in its players this year. And now that's overdue, but some would say it's gone too far, and the transfer portal brings it even to a new level. On the whole, is it too early to tell if it's good or bad or somewhere in between? What's your perception about where we are at this point?
I don't think anybody really knows, Jim. I mean, we tried to get our arms around it in the way that we told all the stories in from various angles in The Price. And, when you listen to Charlie Baker, the new president of the NCAA, and some said to me that he's either going to be the best president or the last president of the NCAA, they're trying to find a framework. Right now, everything is so opaque. The NCAA enforcement staff, which generally has a thankless job on a good day, really can't really investigate and otherwise get to the bottom of what's happening in the portal, how NIL money is being used as inducements. So I think there's just so many unknowns right now. The game itself on the field, I think, has never been more popular and has never been better. But you've got all these headwinds and crosswinds that are just battering the sport. And I think that when you look at certain other coaches who have decided to, I can talk in basketball with Jay Wright, or I can mention Chip Kelly out at UCLA, who left and took a $4 million pay cut as the head coach of the Bruins to become the offensive coordinator at Ohio State. That tells you something. They're just exhausted. And I'm sure Coach Kelly and his staff are dealing with things that they've never had to deal with before. And the fact that you have to generate north, and I think in the SEC, those numbers are right where LSU is, that's kind of the number right now, somewhere between $15 and $20 million a year you have to raise in order to keep your roster. And then when you have situations where, and I think this is the reason that unquestionably that Nick left the game, is because you can develop players and develop them where they're a year away from really contributing or starting for your team. And then all of a sudden you come back and after spring practice, they're saying, well, coach, I'm going into the portal because I've been offered $500,000 to go to school A where I can start right away. So I think there's just so much that is unknown right now that it's going to take at least 2 or 3 years before this thing settles out in any way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm.
The Nick you referred to, of course, Nick Saban with his 7 national titles. He will be 73 in a few months, but I don't think there's any doubt, and you tell me if I'm wrong, that the reason he's out of the game is because of this new environment.
Oh, no question. I mean, Nick can say, and I think he danced around it a little bit, but clearly his testimony before Congress, you know, I've known Nick in one form or fashion since his days as the head coach at the Miami Dolphins. I profiled him in a big way for 60 Minutes. He was a predominant figure in the system. I'm close to Terry, and I think I'm a trusted member of whatever their circle is. And the lack of control, the lack of certainty, the inability to really plan ahead, walking into your office after you lose to Michigan in the playoff game and having a list of players or a line of players out the door talking to you about one thing, money, and or they were going to transfer. And that's just not the environment Nick had spent the last 50 years of his coaching life in. And if you look at the sport right now, as we've, you know, told the story in our book, through the eyes of head coaches and presidents of universities, like, you know, like Bobby Robbins, there's 3 chapters on Michigan and there in the Harbaugh, Ward Manuel, athletic director, NCAA saga, and a team that wins a national championship, to have 2 of the singular, maybe the singular coaches and figures in the game, Jim Harbaugh and Nick Saban, no longer in the game, pushed out for various reasons, different reasons, but still very much a part of the price. It tells you a lot of where the game is right now, where the sport is right now. So, you know, I think John and I have, Lord knows, we put a lot of time and effort into this. And, you know, as you well know, John is a very well-respected, he reminds me kind of a young me. You know, he's relentless. He's got a lot of integrity. He's obsessive in his reporting. He's developed really strong contacts throughout the SEC and nationwide. And, you know, I've done, Jim, now I think this is the 12th book, and a number of them have been New York Times bestsellers.
6 of them, I count. This will be the 7th.
I'm really proud of this one. And I think college football fans, you know, God knows you've got a great fan base down there, a rabid fan base, maybe the best fan base in the country. And if you're trying to figure out and understand mm-hmm. what Coach Kelly and his staff are trying to deal with right now, this book tells you a lot. It covers a lot of ground, and I think you feel it through the characters. And that's where the reporting, I think, really stands out.
The book is The Price, What It Takes to Win in College Football's Era of Chaos. Now, the last 3 LSU coaches have won national titles, and they did so early in their tenure at LSU. And Coach Kelly, of course, is in year 3, and people expect the moon. Right now, yeah. Armin, I only count 3 coaches currently in the ranks who have won national titles, and that's Mack Brown, Dabo Swinney, and Kirby Smart. And you write about Smart. He's got it going at Georgia. Now, Georgia is going to be tough to bring down this year or any other year. They have the preeminent program now, I think, in college, at least in the Southeastern Conference.
No question. And I think, you know, there's 2 chapters on Coach Saban called, you know, the old king, and then the old king won. And then there's a chapter called The Prince on Kirby. And it really fits because Kirby is the successor to Nick in so many ways. He wanted the same organization. I can't tell you how many times I've heard that word come out of Nick's mouth. organization. It's not a program, it's an organization, and you're the CEO of that organization. And Kirby, because of the great fan base and the support he has at Georgia in the history of that program, has really been able to develop it as the premier program in the country. But I can tell you, there's a good story in the book, a great chapter on Julian Sain, the quarterback that was headed and actually enrolled in Alabama. But Coach Kelly really made an impression on Julian's mom, Karen Brandenburg, and when they visited the campus. And I think if Karen had her choice, if she was the recruit that was signing, she would have signed with LSU. But Nick really developed a very strong relationship with Julian. But to give you an idea of how chaotic things are, you know, Julian's in his first day.
Can you hold for just a moment? We don't have much time, but we'll return and spend a few more minutes with Armin Katayan after this brief pause on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to Talk Louisiana. A few more minutes with the remarkable writer, commentator, and chronicler of college athletics, and his latest book is about college football, Armin Katayan, who's also written bestsellers about the likes of Tiger Woods. Now, this one is What It Takes to Win in College Football's Era of Chaos. Most colleges are opening their seasons this week, some last week, but most this week, including LSU and Southern. But it is a new environment, and that was where we were going. And you were talking about one particular recruit who, of course, was getting courted by the great lights of college football coaching, and Brian Kelly and Nick Saban were right in the middle of it, and we had to cut you short, and it was a good story. I wanted you to continue, Armin.
I'll just finish it quick, Jim. So Julian, it's his first, Julian Sain, number one quarterback in the class of 2024, just a generational talent, and he's in his first day of classes in Tuscaloosa, 3 o'clock class. At 4 o'clock, he goes into the team meeting, first team meeting of the official school year for him, and within 5 minutes, Nick has told the team that he's going to retire. So to give you an idea of the only reason that Julian Sain is at Alabama is because of Nick Saban. Now his head coach walks out of the door the first 5 minutes of his after his first class. Julian's now at Ohio State. You know, I think if you get one small microcosm of the chaos, you can take a story like Julian's, or you can take a half a dozen different stories in our book and really show what the, you know, what the world is like right now there.
Well, thank you, my friend, and keep going. You inspire us, and I know you've got a lot of gas in the tank, and this is a great work. The book is The Price, What It Takes to Win in College Football's Era of Chaos, from Armin Katayan and John Talty. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Jim.
It's a pleasure. Thank you. And we're joined now by Melissa Fornoy, the longtime Louisiana activist, former state lawmaker from the great city of Shreveport. And also she is joined by another person who calls Shreveport home. He didn't grow up in Louisiana, but he's been in Shreveport for a long time. And John Milkovich was elected to the state Senate a few years back. He served one term as the most conservative member of the legislature as a Democrat. He's since left the Democratic fold and has some thoughts about where we are in Louisiana, as does Melissa Flournoy, and their views are at opposite ends of the spectrum. And we're starting with state items. Governor Jeff Landry has issued an executive order meant to restrict what Louisiana schools teach about racism. It's the latest instance of Governor Landry leaning into the national culture wars over what students should learn about race, sexuality, and gender. In this order, he has instructed the state superintendent of education, Cade Brumley, to get rid of any policies that promote divisive concepts, including the idea that anyone based on their race or sex is inherently racist or sexist or responsible for historical wrongs. I think we have, from our newsroom at the Louisiana Radio Network, a couple of cuts related to this. And let's go, Robin and Renee, to Valerie Hodges of Denham Springs, a Republican who says Governor Landry is on the right track.
Is in some of the teaching material that I brought to committee and read it. And people had a hard time believing that it's in there, but it's in the teaching manuals. They don't need to be taught that they are hopeless victims or victimizers, or that they're oppressed or they're oppressors.
Okay, and Royce DuPlessis of New Orleans has a different point of view.
I don't know that critical race theory is being taught in public schools, K through 12. I've always known critical race theory to be an advanced course that's usually taught in law school. Nobody's teaching kids based on their race that if you're white, then you're an oppressor, or if you're black or brown, that you're destined to be oppressed.
Okay, that's Royce DuPlessis. Obviously, the battle lines are drawn, but the governor has the mojo. He was elected without a runoff by the citizens of Louisiana. And for those who say he didn't have a mandate, he sure did have a mandate, because people make a decision to vote and not to vote, and those who did vote gave him a majority without a runoff. I know that doesn't square well with you, Melissa Flournoy, but is the governor on track or off track with his move on this front?
Jim, it's just such a distraction. It's just silly. I mean, I think Jeff Landry wakes up in the morning and looks for silly things to talk about. You know, critical race theory is taught in law schools and graduate schools. It's about sort of the role of race in public policy and legal issues. And this is just such red meat to his base. It's a waste of time, and it's a fake controversy. And it just aggravates me that he's not focusing on issues that matter, like teaching kids to read and investing in K-3 literacy programs. And supporting education. It's just more race baiting and red meat.
Now, he says teaching children that they are currently or destined to be oppressed or to be an oppressor based on their race and origin is wrong and has no place in our Louisiana classrooms. And he has
I agree with that. I agree with, you know, part of the stuff that's in there. I don't think anybody's teaching kids that they have ultimately going to be oppressors or oppressed. I think this is just feeding a racist narrative that he's propagating.
Okay, John Milkovich.
And I think it's terrible.
Do you think it's terrible, John?
I don't think it's terrible that what he's doing, Jim, at all. And by the way, hey, Jim and Melissa. Look, the fact of the matter is, and I was blessed to serve as vice chairman of the Louisiana Senate Education Committee for 4 years, which all that means is you can say what you think, but no one has to listen to a single thing that you say. But the fact of the matter is, the people of Louisiana, we're not in control of our education. There is already an agenda in education, and it's pro alternative lifestyles. It's pro abortion. It's pro socialism. It is the Common Core agenda, which was engineered in large part by Bill Gates, who's one of the largest financiers in world history of abortion. And when I was on the Senate Education Committee, I looked at the text that we were given to our children. I'm not talking about middle school or high school. I'm talking first to fifth grade. You cannot believe it unless you've seen the books I have. And we had in those texts that we were given from first to fifth graders references to rape, mutilation, suicide, adultery, war, pillaging, torture. And this is the point. We are the people of Louisiana. Our education, we pay for it. It's our kids, it's our teachers, it's our principals. We should be controlling the content. Of course, that's a battle I've been fighting and kind of been losing for about 10 years. We are not in control of the content of the education of our children. And there's already an agenda. So to say that Jeff Landry is imposing an agenda is 180 degrees wrong. Couldn't be more wrong. There's already an agenda. We need to get rid of it. In fact, I would have gone further than Jeff Landry. I don't think we need Common Core, period. And I don't think we need BSEE board members. He appointed one. I disagree with that. That helped jam Common Core down our throats. I think our education should reflect our values. That would be Christianity, patriotism, and honor. Bible values. Go ahead and call me old school. I don't think there's anything wrong with our students being taught right.
All right. Well, let's get Melissa to you gave her a lot to chew on.
Yeah, well, let me just back up. Let's say dial it down and let's focus on reality, okay?
Well,
the Board of Elementary and Secondary Education and the Superintendent of Education have been dominated by Republicans, starting with Bobby Jindal, okay? So let's go back. We're now 16 years later, 20 years later into Republican control of K-12 education in Louisiana. Fact. The only agenda in public education in Louisiana is around the privatization and charter schools, okay? Republicans have controlled the curriculum development at BSEE and the Department of Education for 20 years, all right? and we have a set curriculum that's approved through an extensive process. And let's just be real. The only agenda in education in Louisiana is privatization, taking money out of private schools, funding charter schools, reducing quality education by not paying teachers. The problem in education is not CRT. It's quality teachers and lack of investment in K-12 education. The rest of this is just smoke and mirrors.
John?
Absolutely. Well, you are right about one thing. There was a bunch of rhinos that bought in on our Common Core, and one of them was Bobby Jindal, who is now, by the way, affiliated with the World Economic Forum and Klaus, whatever his name is, people who want the globalists. But I actually fought Democrats and rhinos, and in fact, I probably had to fight the rhinos as hard as
okay, we're going to take a break. We'll return with Milkovich and Flournoy.
About reality.
This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to Talk Louisiana, produced today by Renee Martin and Robin Dow, and your number 877-217-5757. We're visiting with Melissa Flournoy, the former state lawmaker from Shreveport, and John Milkovich, former state lawmaker from Shreveport. That's about all they have in common. but they're both passionate, very passionate. And surprisingly, they seem to get along okay with each other, and we hope that you'll be cordial to our callers, or to our guests, if you are a caller. And again, it's 877-217-5757. We're talking...
Jim, can I follow up on one thing?
Sure.
About
sure.
Critical race theory? Okay. You know, I think that the governor and the legislature needs to read an article called Toward a Critical Race Theory of Education. It's one of the seminal pieces on critical race theory. And do you know who wrote it, Jim? The president of LSU, William F. Tate IV.
Who now has backed off. He's backed off.
And he's a critical race scholar.
I know he is, but he got rid of the DEI at LSU on the eve of Governor Landry taking office.
I know. There's in the book on tyranny, it's called Obedience and Abeyance. It's sort of like you are doing this stuff, sort of backtracking in order to avoid, you know, losing your job, essentially. But it's actually a really interesting article that explains some of the background on critical race theory. And so, John Milkovich, I will send you this article if you will send me the information on curriculum in the K-12 program, because I really do believe facts matter, and we do need to know what we're talking about. So right. I just wanted to put that out there.
Well, let's get Senator Milkovich to respond. John?
I'm sorry, Melissa, I do want to respond, and I am talking about facts. I'm talking about texts that I read myself. The boys wore, this is what we gave to kids in the fifth grade when I was still in Louisiana Senate. Intestines hanging out of dead soldiers, ripped flesh, eyes punctured, severed arms and legs. In fourth grade, we got gifts of the goddesses that included references to goddesses of vengeance, snake about their waist, serpents twined in their hair, blood dripping from their black eyes. Woods runner, fourth grade, man's head eaten by a bear, murdered people that seem like trash, paper cloth.
Okay, I think we get the idea, John. Let's give this a break. I don't think this is going to be a productive conversation based on where it's going, but 69 days away from an election, and these issues that are permeating in the state are often displayed in full bloom on the national stage, and we are in a case where we have two candidates who are partisans. Donald Trump has had an evolution philosophically in his life, and he's gone from a liberal Democrat to a conservative Republican, and now, of course, he's now trying to go back to his liberal ways on abortion, but it's probably too late. I know that's your big issue, John. Do you think Trump is betraying the cause by saying that states ought to make their decisions and that Louisiana should stay out of the politics of California when it comes to abortion? Is President Trump on the right track, or has he betrayed you?
Okay, yeah, several questions. But I'll say, yes, he is on the right track. I will say, for the record, I am more extreme than Donald Trump on pro-life. I think every human life from the moment of conception is human life, which should be respected by man. We're made in the image of God, and God values human life, so should we. I'm against abortion, period. I do think it's a right step for Donald Trump to place this issue in the states. And it was a centerpiece of his theology and philosophy, and he did it. You got to give him credit. He's the one that appointed justices to the Supreme Court who had concern for unborn babies. And honestly, I think it's a philosophical non sequitur for us ever to say, I'm for the future, I'm for kids, I'm for hope and joy and all these things that some of the Democrats say they're for. And let's start with killing babies. And by the way, let's go ahead and emotionally and psychologically camouflage it. We're going to go ahead and call that, instead of killing unborn babies, we're going to call it reproductive freedom. And
well,
reproductive
he tweeted the other day that he's going to be the greatest president ever for reproductive rights. And if you believe that abortion is killing babies, how can you ever sanction it? How can you ever say California has the right to say that they want to have women make the choice rather than their lawmakers?
So if he said that, I disagree with it 100%, because I'm for God before I'm for Donald Trump, and I'm for unborn babies because God is. But I will say this. I'm not just looking at a single statement that someone says in a 24-hour news cycle. I'm looking at actions, what people have done, and what they've actually performed. And what he did is he helped get three pro-life justices on the United States Supreme Court who finally said, had the courage, along with their Alito and Thomas, to say, look, America no longer, and we'll give Roberts credit, America no longer needs to be a slaughterhouse for
all right, let's get Melissa's view
million.
On this. I think she has a different point of view. Melissa?
I think she does.
Dr. Flournoy?
Listen, you know, there's way too much heat around this conversation. You know, it's not about being pro-life. It really is about how do we control women and their reproductive health. And if you're really concerned about unborn babies, then we need to be focusing on access to health care, contraception, and family planning. We need to be talking about educating young men. It takes two pieces of a puzzle to make a baby, okay? Part of what I'm worried about is this radical, what they call a radical pro-life agenda is damaging women's health care. Look at what's happened to Nancy Davis and Caitlin Joshua, having a miscarriage and being denied care. We have just lost our minds around this issue around health care. It's affecting the quality of care for pregnant women. Women can't even get a prenatal appointment until after 12 weeks because doctors are afraid women might miscarry. We have just gone way too far away from what we should be talking about, the rights of individuals to health care, the rights of women and men to control their own fertility, the need to educate people about contraception and family planning.
All right.
And so let's come back and focus on what we really need to be talking about.
We are 69 days away from the election, and there are other issues in play between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris. 877-217-5757. Please be brief. We do have some folks waiting to talk with Senator Milkovich and Dr. Flournoy. Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, you're on.
Yeah, good morning, Ms. Flournoy. You know, I would two predictions, Code Pink. There are going to be hundreds of thousands of women marching as they did in 2016 to protest those idiots.
All right, what's your question, Phil?
Smith case is going to be allowed to move forward because they're...
All right, that's not a question. Dan downtown. Dan, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana. Hello, Dan. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning. Yes, Senator, is it of any concern to you that because they genuflect at the altar of Grover Norquist, the supposedly pro-life Republicans would not vote even 1 cent in taxes for the education and health care of the children who are born?
All right. I think that's a question that should be directed to both. John, is that...
Listen.
Go ahead.
You know, and thank you, Dan. Jim, and also I know Dan Schuerman personally. Listen, America is investing hundreds of billions of dollars in governmental programs for health, medicine, family planning. And look, at some point, we got to get back to basics. The government cannot raise the American family. Washington can't even balance their own budget, and we're going to entrust the Washington, D.C. bureaucrats, which is a huge, what is there, hundreds of thousands of federal employees, we're going to entrust them to go ahead and structure and direct and orchestrate what happens to American families. What about we get back to self-reliance, self-independence, self-governance, and Bible values? I mean, we have a God that gave us a word that says this is how you're supposed to act.
All right.
And the notion that one more government program is going to be a fix, the more government programs we get, the further behind we are.
All right, Melissa, Dr. Flournoy.
Okay, I actually happen to agree with John Milkovich that we should be talking about parental responsibility and family rights and freedom. Okay, I believe in the freedom of families to raise their kids. I think there is an appropriate role of government. You know, I think we get all twisted up and wanting to throw rocks at each other. I will say I was raised a Southern Baptist, but there are more religions than just Christians. And we have a multicultural, democratic country. And so I do not think that only focusing on the Bible from a public sector governmental response is appropriate.
All right, but James and Metairie. James and Metairie, you're on with Dr. Flournoy and Senator Milkovich.
Good morning. Hey, Senator, do you agree with teaching all the Bible, such as Deuteronomy chapter 22, verses 20-21? If a man finds that his wife is not a virgin, she's to be brought to the door of her father's house, where the men of the town shall stone her to death.
All right, John, do you interpret the Bible literally, some of those passages that some might say are out of date?
Let me respond very specifically. Let's go ahead and talk about the whole Bible. The whole Bible includes the New Testament, which, if you recall, sir, when Joseph found out that his wife was pregnant, the Bible says that being a just man and being merciful and not wanting to submit his wife to punishment or humiliation, he decided to leave the marriage. Of course, the angel, the Bible says God then sent the angel to inform him, by the way, Jesus was born of the Holy Spirit and the overshadowing of the Spirit of God. So let's go ahead and talk about the whole Bible. Not one phrase taken out of context. It is true, and I'm glad you brought that point up. God does place a great emphasis on family unity and structure and integrity. That includes husbands and wives being faithful to each other. And guess what? What do we see? I mean, and this is not highfalutin social philosophy. This is Joe the bartender, Ramad Inn. What I noticed.
We do have to take a break. So let's pause, and hopefully we'll get to Beyond the Bible, which implores us to be like Jesus, which means we should be bench pressing our weight, guys, including you, John Milkovich, back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number, and a few more minutes with Dr. Melissa Flournoy, former state lawmaker, and former state senator John Milkovich. We are talking national politics for a few more moments, and we are inside 10 weeks, and it is all but a dead heat, if you believe in polls, particularly in the swing states, all seven of them within the margin of error. 877-217-5757 if you'd like to get in under the wire. James in Longview, Texas. James, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Well, good morning, all. Anyhow, one of your guests was saying that they're getting sick of people throwing rocks at each other, as am I. I was just wondering if more issues would be better solved at the state level to have people actually closer to the action and talking to each other. I know some things have to be federal, but shouldn't a lot more things be state?
All right. Dr. Flournoy, should the state, should we have states' rights?
I think we have an issue around tolerance and conversation and being able to deal with facts at the local level, the state level, and the federal level. So, yes, I think we're dealing with a lot of issues at the state level, but we've really got to start paying attention to how to have civil discourse and not just shout at each other. And so I think we're just way too ideological right now, and we need to focus on pragmatic solutions to improve people's lives. That's what I think we need to be focusing on.
Senator?
Of course we need to decide things at the state level. And look, Jim, I'm probably the perfect person to generate a bunch of angry phone calls this morning because this is my firm conviction. If Donald Trump is in prison, I'm voting for him. I am a 2020 election denier, and Donald Trump, and I think it's important that we elect him as president so that we can preserve the state's rights. He isn't perfect, but he's against the isms. He's against communism, against Marxism, against socialism, against globalism.
All right, and Kamala Harris is for all those things?
Well, yes. Yeah, I think she is a sock puppet for the Democratic establishment, which is really the same thing as the globalist establishment, which is honestly, in terms of their impact on America, is a Marxist-Leninist playbook where they are trying to deteriorate or cause the disintegration of
America.
Right.
Well, let's get Melissa's take. I have a feeling she believes Kamala Harris is on the right track.
Well, I do feel like we need to be talking about a hopeful future for our country. And I do think that Kamala Harris and Governor Walz have a hopeful vision for the future to try and bring people together and not focus on a dark, dystopian, fascist, authoritarian future being promoted by Donald Trump and the billionaire class that wants to take away the freedoms of American citizens. So I think we're throwing around words way too much that nobody understands. And the bottom line is who's going to try and make our country better, who's going to help our kids, who's going to support our families, who's going to reduce crime, who's going to help people have a higher standard quality of life. And frankly, I think that is anybody but Donald Trump.
All right, final caller for John and Melissa. David in Atlanta, please be brief, David.
Hello?
Yes, David, you're on.
Okay, Mr. Malkovich, I'm glad to hear you're a believer in the Christian Bible. Now, you just pointed out what you believe are shortcomings by Kamala Harris. Donald Trump mocked, ridiculed, gloated, and laughed at the disability of a New York Times reporter.
He did. What's your question, David?
Well, this is my question. Did Donald Trump behave as a believer in Jesus, or is he a heathen? And if so, why would you support a heathen?
Well, you know, I'm not going to support him because he's perfect, because the only perfect man that ever lived got nailed to a cross. This is what we don't talk about. This is the things that Donald Trump didn't do. He didn't start wars for his friends to make money. He didn't have his political opponents or people that had information on him assassinated. He didn't participate in international drug rings. He didn't participate in terrorist attacks against America on American soil, and that's, by the way, I'm referring to 9/11. If you do the research on that, our top intel and government officials had scads of warnings about that. Did nothing. He
all right, and that would be President Bush, not a Democrat. But Melissa, we'll give you the final word. John is obviously a passionate man, a sincere fellow, and I like him. But I don't agree with much of what he just said. But that's why we have you to counter him if you so choose.
Here's what I want to say. This election is consequential. It's about a vision for each community and each family. It's a hopeful vision for the future of our country. It's about promoting the rights of individuals to make their own decisions, to live their lives in freedom. Donald Trump wants to limit your freedom, and Kamala Harris wants to provide a way forward in the 21st century to improve the quality of life of all Americans. And so choose wisely. And Jim, thanks for the opportunity to be on today.
Well, it's an honor to speak with both of you, Senator Milkovich and Dr. and former state rep, Melissa Flordoy. Thank you. And we're joined in our final moments by Henry Hayes, a co-founder of Disrupt Ready. It's a company that offers AI in a day, workshops and more for companies and businesses. And it implores businesses to implement AI into their work seamlessly and professionally. And of course, many people are concerned about this new world we're in, and which AI is a big part of it. Your thoughts, Henry, about where we are and why you believe that what we are dealing with is not something we should be alarmed about. It may be more of a panacea than an alarm bell. What are your thoughts?
A pleasure to be with you, Jim, this morning. Several things. Look, this is the most powerful technology that any of us have seen in our business lifetimes. Most of the work we do at Disrupt Ready deals with business executives in traditional business setups. The problem with AI and machine learning as opposed to, let's say, the internet, which is late 90s, early 2000s, you would have had several years and several business cycles to plan and strategize and put your roadmap together on an internet strategy. We don't have that time with artificial intelligence because it's moving so quickly. And I think that's one of the things that's really causing a lot of panic, the angst. There is unknown for sure, but it's moving at such a speed that we're just simply not used to as humans. So that's one of the big challenges so far.
877-217-5757 is your number. And our guest is Henry Hayes, an authority on artificial intelligence. And a listener asked a good question about NVIDIA, which has been the hot stock in America. Its market capital is now over $3 trillion, making it one of the three most valuable companies in the world. $3 trillion, that is. And it's gone from $39 a share today at $125 in less than a year. Your thoughts about how people can capitalize on market in the market on artificial intelligence?
So be careful with the trading advice, Jim. I would say this. The deeper, longer trades to me are in the energy sector. And I think that the backbones or the picks and shovels of artificial intelligence, NVIDIA is a great example, so is AMD, because they make what are called GPUs, graphical processing units. These are the bits of hardware that make the data, the ability to analyze the data so quickly. So they are the backbone of this. But I would say we need to wake up and open our eyes to the fact that we're going to need 20 to 30 times the energy that we produce today, Jim, to be able to commercially use artificial intelligence. So that is a gigantic opportunity for an energy producer or producers. And so I would look in those fields.
Now, Henry Hayes was previously senior vice president for Empower Health, a Dallas-based healthcare company that focuses on delivering care using technology. You have over 20 years of experience in biotechnology and pharmacology. How are those areas being affected by AI?
Yeah, so at a root level, Jim, think about workflow. In all those jobs you just mentioned, somebody's Monday through Friday involves the mundane, the boring, the tedious, the repetitive. We take a look at those things and look to pull those out of the workers Monday through Friday. And when we can do that, you give them time back to be more creative, to do things that might involve client interactions. In the pharma world, I could tell you some of the biggest uses of AI early will be they can radically speed up their phase one and phase two trials because we can run simulations, millions upon millions of code that we simply couldn't do if the humans are kind of hands at the wheel. So, but we look at for the mundane, the boring, and the tedious, and that's a great place to start.
Well, this is something that, as I stated going in, people are in many cases concerned and maybe even alarmed by. Should we put the pause button on the panic?
I believe that Elon Musk has it right, Jim, when he says, look, we do need guardrails. We cannot be cowboys in the wild, wild west with this technology because that's a bad idea. So I believe he's correct. I do not believe, however, we have the right people in seats of power that are making these laws and rules. That is a problem. I think we need a much more diverse group of folks with different opinions, both in the tech and the non-tech side of the technology. Because look, this is a global tool, meaning whatever we do in America, let's put up against the Indians, the Chinese, the Brazilians, the Russians. Are they going to follow suit? And the answer is probably no. And so I think these are big challenges and problems we have to solve.
Does it affect the political environment?
100%. And unfortunately, artificial intelligence is going to get the bad rap, but the humans will tell the tool, Jim, what to do. And so you'll have what are called deep fakes. You've already probably seen those as we get closer to November 5th. And yeah, it's here. And we're going to have to suss out what that disinformation and all those terms that we've gotten used to as Americans, what that means, because it's here.
Thank you, Henry Hayes, and we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place, for Renee Martin and Robin Dow. I'm Jim Inkster. Stay safe and stay tuned.